This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Philip Warburg. Philip is author of Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy of Independence, and Climate Stability. He has served as president of the Conservation Law Foundation, as executive director of the Israel Union for Environmental Defense, and as a senior attorney for the Environmental Law Institute. Philip Warburg is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future, published in 2015. Welcome, Philip.
Great to be on your show.
What is the purpose of your book, Harness the Sun?
I tend to describe it as an exercise in responsible optimism. There's an enormous amount we can do if we really get serious about tapping the sun. We need the right policies in place, and we need a sufficiently broad vision of just how profound the transformation is that we're going to have to undergo if we're going to move toward a post-carbon-based future.
How much does solar contribute to our current energy mix in the U.S.?
Don't be shocked, but less than 0.5%. That said, in the first 6 months of 2015, solar energy contributed 39% of all new electric generating capacity. And if you add to that 36% for wind power, you're looking at 3/4 of our new electric generating capacity this year coming from renewable energy. So we're really at the beginning of the takeoff phase for solar energy, which is part of what makes me excited about researching this issue.
What type of solar installations are currently in use in the U.S.?
One of the great things about solar energy is it has many, many different applications. We have installed solar on our own home, and we get 75% of our total power needs from that array. And I should mention that our home is in snowy, chilly Massachusetts. And one of the interesting things about solar that some people don't know is that photovoltaics actually work better in colder weather. And in Massachusetts, we have a fairly sunny climate, even though it's a very cold climate. So that's one opportunity. Another is warehouse roofs in places like New Jersey. I climbed up onto a number of them, very productive. We can talk about brownfields, industrial brownfields, where solar is being developed on a very substantial scale. And there is solar on open spaces, such as farmlands and some areas of the desert in the Southwest. So what's great about solar is that you really can apply it in any number of contexts.
And would you also say a few words about PV versus other types of solar?
The predominant use of solar energy right now is PV or photovoltaics. It's a very efficient and less expensive way to go than what's called concentrating solar power, which is based upon capturing the sun's heat as opposed to a portion of the sun's light. We are seeing some large concentrating solar facilities built on a utility scale in the Southwest. The conditions need to be optimal in terms of climate. The advantage to them is that you can store the solar energy more easily because you're capturing the heat in molten salt, which retains that heat. But again, it is more expensive.
What type of solar installations provide the most U.S. solar energy?
Right now, the greatest amount of solar energy is actually coming from utility scale solar projects. They're cheaper to build per watt. You have to find, again, the right locations, but they are very productive. And I should mention that it's one example of where federal incentives have played a very important role. In 2009, there was almost no utility-scale solar power being built. The Federal Loan Guarantee Program, which some people associate with the bankruptcy of a company called Solyndra, actually has been instrumental in getting utility-scale solar launched. What it has done is it has provided loan guarantees to a number of utility-scale projects and has brought utility-scale solar really into the mainstream.
Looking at PV and all rooftop capacity, what is a realistic goal for future solar rooftop installations?
The National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which is our government laboratory investigating renewable energy, estimates that we could be getting about 1/5 of our total power needs nationwide from rooftop solar alone. So that's a great place to begin. I don't think it's enough, but I think it's a very encouraging sign that what you could do on your home and I could do on my home and someone else could do on his or her business could really make a very big difference in transitioning us to a renewable energy future.
What are the different ways a homeowner can arrange for solar power?
One option, the most straightforward perhaps, is to actually purchase the solar array. The advantage to that has been that there have been various incentives, state as well as federal. One of the issues that is coming up very soon is that at the end of 2016, the federal investment tax credit, that's a 30% tax credit, will sunset unless Congress literally sees the light and extends it. So that's an important thing to keep in mind, that we really need to keep the right kinds of solar subsidies and pro-solar policies on the books. We're very accustomed to subsidies for oil and gas and coal remaining unquestioned, yet somehow Congress seems to feel that solar and wind should be subject to practically annual scrutiny, which is quite unfortunate. The other way to go with solar is to engage a solar company in what's called a power purchase agreement. So that company will install a solar array on your roof for no charge upfront, and then will sell you the solar electricity at an agreed upon rate, which is usually lower than the rate you've been paying to your utility. You can also lease a solar array so that you're paying a lease payment to that company, and then you enjoy whatever solar output comes from that particular array. So the opportunities are really proliferating in terms of the different ways that you can tap the sun on your roof.
Which states have installed the most solar power so far?
Not Washington. California is way in the lead. It has installed over 10,000 megawatts of solar capacity. Interestingly, Massachusetts, my home state, has installed about 850 megawatts of solar capacity. Washington has installed about 40 megawatts of solar capacity. So you certainly have opportunities that have yet to be tapped.
What has been the reason certain states have installed more solar than other states?
Well, the sun is a factor, but I think people perhaps exaggerate that. Some people say in Washington, for example, that, well, we're not a very sunny state. And as you know, the eastern part of Washington is a very sunny area. Even Seattle, though, has a much higher rate of solar exposure than German cities, for example. And Germany is the world leader in installed solar capacity. There are about 2,100 hours of sunlight in Seattle per year. In Germany, that number is more on the order of about 1,500 hours. So there is real opportunity here to be tapped. Many states are engaging solar on various levels, and we're seeing it develop really day by day on a much more rapid level than we have in the past.
What have been the forces behind the states installing solar?
There are various policies that are very important. One is what is called a renewable portfolio standard or a renewable electricity standard. What that standard does is it requires utilities to provide a certain minimum percentage of the power that they supply to their customers from renewable sources, certain kinds of renewable sources. So, for example, in Washington, you have a lot of large-scale hydroelectricity, which does not count under the renewable electricity standard. It could be wind, it could be solar, it could be various kinds of geothermal, for example, ground-sourced heat that is used. And the renewable portfolio standard is probably the number one catalyst to renewable energy development. There are other mechanisms, for example, solar net metering, which allows you to put solar on your home and sell that power to the grid when you're not actually using that power. That's a very important mechanism so that we don't have to be bound by exactly when that power is being produced.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Philip Warburg, author of the book Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What is being done to help low-income households install solar?
That's an important question. There are new programs that are developing in various states. California is really in the lead. Right now, California has a program that provides $300 million in aid to low-income households to make sure that they can enjoy solar power. And what happens is that certain qualifying families are identified. A nonprofit named Grid Alternatives comes in and supervises a volunteer crew to install solar power on the roofs of those families. I visited one of those families in the Bayview district of San Francisco, recent immigrants from China, who now get 90% of their total power needs from the sun, which is a wonderful benefit to them in terms of reducing their electric bills, and it's a great benefit to us in reducing our overall carbon footprint.
You've alluded a bit to this already, but what are the current government incentives to install solar?
Well, at the federal level, the investment tax credit is very important, and as I said, it is vulnerable to sunsetting by the U.S. Congress. At the state level, in Washington, for example, you have a very impressive renewable energy production incentive program, which is important in Washington because power is very cheap here because of hydroelectricity. You pay about 8 to 9 cents per kilowatt hour. We in Massachusetts pay about double that. So the production incentive really makes it worthwhile for people to invest in solar here. That program will sunset in the coming years. It's already reaching its cap in certain utility districts. So making sure there's continuity there will be very important.
Would you say more about what local communities are doing to encourage solar?
There are various measures that can be taken. One very important measure is to make sure that people have what's called solar access rights. I encountered one individual who's an official with a company called NRG Energy, who was showing me a solar installation at Gillette Stadium, the home of the New England Patriots. And he's been very involved in getting solar installed at various NFL stadiums. And I, as a matter of course, asked him if he had solar on his home in Houston, Texas. And he looked a little embarrassed and he said, well, actually, I don't, because I am living in an area where the Homeowners Association bans solar. Since that time, the state of Texas has introduced legislation and the governor has signed legislation that requires that any homeowners association with more than 50 members must allow solar to be developed. So those kinds of local barriers are very important to make sure we can move beyond if we're going to see solar develop in all communities. But there are also local policies and strategies that are being developed, and not always in predictable places. One might think of Marin County, a very progressive, enlightened place, as a prime spot for developing solar, and it is. Less probable is the city of Lancaster, which is in the Mojave Desert. It's a town of about 160,000 people, used to be a center of gang violence. In 2008, a mayor was elected there named Rex Parris, very right-wing, hardline crime fighter, who came in and was quite effective in fighting crime, not necessarily in the kindest, gentlest way, let's just say. He has been as utterly determined to implement solar on a very large scale and has announced that he wants Lancaster to be the solar capital of the world. And he's taken a number of steps to actually make Lancaster a net solar energy exporter within the next few years. So I think we can look across the political spectrum and see where different communities are engaging solar with energy and enthusiasm.
How promising is the conversion of brownfields and abandoned or other industrial property to solar installations?
That's one of the really promising untapped areas. We're beginning to see brownfields developed for solar. I should mention to your listeners that brownfields are contaminated or potentially contaminated properties. They might have been landfills, they might have been mining areas, they could have been factory sites. And the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which I mentioned before, has done a study of over 100,000 brownfield sites. And as a result of that study, they estimate that we could be getting 3 times our total power needs nationwide from the sun. We're not necessarily going to see all those sites developed, but it's just an indicator of how superabundant the solar potential is, even on lands that we really don't have very productive alternative uses for.
What is an example of a successful conversion of brownfields or industrial land to solar?
I visited a number of these sites. One of them was in the West Pullman neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. International Harvester used to assemble farming equipment there until the 1980s when it abandoned the site, and it left a very polluted site that was a health hazard as well as an environmental hazard and certainly a visual blight for the local community. This is a very poor, crime-ridden part of the South Side. Exelon came in around 2009 and built what's called the Exelon City Solar Facility, cleaned up the site to some degree. It didn't have to engage in full cleanup because it's not being used for residential or commercial purposes. But today, on that site, enough electricity is generated for about 1,500 households. And I wish I could say that it had solved the problem of crime in that area. Unfortunately, the major cause of breakage of panels at that facility is stray bullets falling from the sky. However, what was a visual blight and what was a real hazard to local residents is now a positive economic and environmental amenity.
How much land would be needed to supply all of U.S. power from the sun?
This is an outdated survey, but I haven't found a more recent reliable number. About 21,000 square miles would be needed if we were to supply all of our electricity from the sun. Now, that's about 0.6% of our total land area, and it's less than 2% of the land that is now in active cultivation. So it is a good amount of land, let's just say. Again, what we need to do is distribute our solar ambitions across a number of different contexts so that we're not just building on open spaces, although building on open spaces is one way to get a major increment in our solar power. And that number, I should mention, assumes a very high level of investment in storage, and it also was based upon technology that was current in 2007, 2008. So those numbers should be coming down, and I hope we'll see a more recent study coming forward soon.
What types of sites are being considered and developed for utility-scale solar projects?
We're seeing fallow farmland being developed in various areas, which is a great reuse of farmland. If you look at California today, as of 2013, more than 250,000 acres were still in active cultivation of cotton, not an essential food crop, needless to say, a very water-hungry crop. One could imagine those kinds of areas being converted to solar. And we are seeing solar developed at a number of sites, again, across the country, but I'll take one as an example, which is the California Valley Solar Ranch, which is on the Carrizo Plain, sometimes referred to somewhat generously as California's Serengeti. It does have some valued wildlife, and the developer of that project, a company called SunPower, has gone to great pains to, for example, relocate the San Joaquin kit fox and the giant kangaroo rats that occupied the site that they have built there. And after construction, they allowed those creatures to re-inhabit the site. They also built migratory corridors through that site. And I should mention that this is a site that generates enough electricity for 100,000 people on about 1,400 acres of solar arrays. So we're looking at a really huge contributor to utility-based solar in California on sites such as that.
Well, you mentioned potential effects on wildlife, but what are the other environmental impacts of concern in installing utility-scale solar?
Well, there is a growing tension between different segments of the environmental and conservation community. Renewable energy advocates say we need to take major steps to break our dependence upon fossil fuels, and that is going to mean that we have to tap resources in various locations, including open spaces. Some segments of the land conservation community say, wait a minute, we don't want to, quote, industrialize our open spaces. So there is that tension, and we'll see that tension play out more in future years as we watch solar develop. And I think, again, we have to look at the big picture in terms of the utter devastation that we're going to see to our environment if we don't make a transition to renewable energy. It's not just about the individual plot of land. It's about the overall ecosystems and human populations that are going to suffer as a result of our dependence upon fossil fuels.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Philip Warburg, author of the book Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. How long do our current solar panels last?
One of the interesting things about solar technology is it actually is much more durable than just about any other appliance that we purchase. One of the challenges that has been faced in testing solar panels is because they last so long, you have to simulate that very long lifespan and figure out just how durable these panels are. Panels last for easily 25 years. They can be productive for 30 years, 35 years, 40 years, the photovoltaics themselves lose about 0.5% of their output per year. After several decades of exposure to harsh weather, there can be an issue with delamination of the solar arrays themselves, the solar panels themselves, but they are a very durable technology.
What is currently being done with solar panels at the end of their life cycle?
Well, we're just beginning to see that challenge engaged, and this is an area where Europe is way ahead of us. The European hazardous waste management regime regards solar panels as something that should be handled as waste to be treated with care. And even though, in fact, most photovoltaic panels contain truly minimal amounts of waste that one would have to be worried about, but there is a recycling challenge, meaning a lot of metals are used in the framing of solar panels. There's glass that can be recycled. There are certain kinds of solar panels called thin film panels that do contain some modest amounts of cadmium telluride and some other materials that one has to be careful about. In Europe, by 2018, 80% of all solar panels that are being discarded must be recycled responsibly for free. And that is a great model, I think, for us to consider. One of the challenges we face in America is we're a wonderful laboratory of experimentation across our states. That also creates some inconsistency. And so what you don't want is for California, for example, to develop a rigorous waste management regime, but Nevada and Arizona to be a kind of free dumping zone so that you have solar panels going across the border to where there are no regulations. It would be great if we had standard federal regulations that established a mandatory recycling regime for solar waste.
Which countries are currently the leaders in solar production and installation?
Here, too, we have a kind of counterintuitive situation where Germany, which really does not get much sunlight, is the world leader by a pretty substantial margin. It has in installed capacity about 38,000 megawatts of solar power. The United States now ranks number 4. We have about 20,000 megawatts of electric generating capacity from the sun. And other leaders are China, Japan, Italy.
How large is the current U.S. solar workforce?
About 174,000 people, and they expect that will be going up considerably as we ramp up the industry in the years ahead.
What are the key challenges at present for the U.S. solar industry?
I think one of the key challenges really is continuity, and that's a factor that comes into play again when we're looking at federal policies and when we're looking at state incentives. Any new industry needs a degree of predictability going forward. So, for example, if you're going to build a manufacturing plant, you don't think about it operating safely for the next 5 years. You think about the next, let's say, 15 years, 20 years. And with the solar investment tax credit potentially going away at the end of 2016, we're looking at a discontinuity that could be quite disruptive to the solar industry.
In what ways will an increased use of solar disrupt the utility status quo?
Well, I think utilities right now are really reeling from the entrance of this new technology and from wind technology. We're really at a transformation point in terms of how we generate power, how we store power, and how we use power. It used to be that a utility would build a coal-fired power plant, turn it on 1 year, and basically turn it off 50 years later. Same thing with a nuclear power plant, hoping for nothing to happen in the interim. And today, what we have are intermittent power sources, such as wind and solar, that require a much more sophisticated management capability on the part of utilities, so that utilities are really going to need to become energy services providers and not just generators of kilowatt hours. They're very dependent right now upon selling electricity to you and me, and they're not very creative at coming up with other means of storing electricity, which is what you need to do with intermittent power supplies, and with what's called demand response, where you're developing smart use of electricity within your home. You don't need to know exactly when your refrigerator and its various functions are operating. What you need to know is that your refrigerator will remain cold and that your ice maker will be producing that ice. And utilities could be modulating our use of those kinds of appliances, of industrial air conditioning and other such technologies, so that we can perfectly match the power that we're generating with the power that we are needing.
How much of our energy mix is likely to be provided by solar in the future?
Going back to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, a few years ago it did a study called Renewable Electricity Futures, and it estimated that using technology that is commercially available today, we could be getting half of our total power needs from the sun and the wind by 2050. And I want to emphasize the technology that is commercially available today, because what we're seeing happen with solar technology is substantial improvements in efficiency year to year. That number to me is conservative. It may sound like a pretty dramatic shift to renewable energy. I think we could very easily be getting 3/4 of our power from the sun and the wind by the middle of this century.
What types of solar installations are likely to be most prevalent in the future?
I think we're going to see solar used on all of the scales that we've been discussing. I think household solar is a very important way for individual homeowners to take charge of at least a portion of the power that they consume. I think we're going to see more and more of it on warehouse roofs, on big box stores. Walmart today has more than 250 solar arrays on its buildings, and its goal is to have 1,000 of its buildings equipped with solar going forward. And we're seeing lots of other industries do the same kind of thing. So I think at those levels, it's also utility scale solar, where we're going to be building large solar fields that will be generating major increments of power for us. And the great thing again about solar is that it's a kind of mix and match. Where it is best to use residential, we'll use residential. Where we can use business-based solar, we will do that. There's another element to solar, which is actually quite, I think, hopeful, and that is what's called community solar, where people whose homes, let's say, are shaded by trees or have a roof orientation that is not optimal for solar, can buy shares in a community solar facility and then enjoy the solar output from that facility according to the shares that they buy. The Seattle Aquarium is one example of a community solar facility right here in your hometown.
How can we best support the development of solar power going forward?
Well, I think we can start by making the right choices ourselves in installing solar power on our homes and businesses and nonprofit organizations. And I think we need to encourage the right policies at the state and federal levels so that we can, again, get the continuity that will allow solar, a nascent technology, to catch up with the oil and gas and coal industries and nuclear industries that have been enjoying federal support for so long.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Solar power is a wonderfully diverse and inexhaustible resource that we can responsibly tap. It isn't without its challenges. No technology is. But I think that we can really see it as a major contributor to a future where America is a leader and not a laggard in the battle against climate change.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Great being on your show.
You were just listening to Philip Warburg, author of the book Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future, published in 2015 by Beacon Press. For more information, check on the web at philipwarburg.com. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.